Hello there and welcome to this week's edition of The Front Page. The weather is getting warmer outside, as it was at Ascot on Saturday when we had an unusually heated edition of the Shergar Cup. We should be looking back on that, on Group 1 wins for Billy Lucknan, Ashin Murphy and Amma Racing at the Curragh, and looking back on last week's announcements regarding the British fixture list in 2026. And I promise you, it will be interesting. It will be interesting because the two people with me, Lee Motta, said, are fascinating individuals. Chris Cook and Liam Head. Hello, gentlemen.
Hey, yeah.
Hello, hello. We'll start by talking about the Shergar Cup, which took place at Ascot on Saturday. It's a bit of fun, is the Shergar Cup. That's what it's there for, to help along with those 2 weeks in between Goodwood and York. And it was a bit of fun. I was there on Saturday. I'm a regular Shergar Cup attendee. I'm a fan of the Shergar Cup and I was enjoying it as usual. They had an MC, Andy Collins, who was really getting race goers excited before the first race. A DJ, Tony Perry, who was doing what DJs do around the paddock, and people appeared to be enjoying it. There was dancing around the steppings. And then the racing started and things maybe took a slightly different turn, particularly after a couple of the races, one of which Ian Williams won, a regular at the Shergar Cup. And Ian was complaining about really other people in his profession, saying it was shameful that races so valuable at Ascot weren't getting full fields. But then we had criticism from another winning trainer, or winning trainer's representative, Maureen Haggis. Her husband William won the fifth race on the card with a three-year-old middle distance handicapper called Tentacles, ridden by French female jockey Delphine Santiago. And after that, Maureen Haggis complained about the quality of some of the riders taking part at this year's Shergar Cup and claimed that one or two maybe shouldn't be there. It was, though, a day that had plenty of people there, around 18,000 people at Ascot on Saturday. But that in itself raises question marks because the numbers have fallen across the last few years, 24,000 down to 22,000 down to 18,000, having previously been an event pre-COVID that would regularly get between 28,000 and 33,000 people there. So, gentlemen, lots to talk about Shergar Cup Day on Saturday. Chris, I know you're also a Shergar Cup aficionado. The front runner made that clear last week and indeed today. What was your take on this unusually controversial renewal?
Like you, I have this sort of instinct of defending the Shergar Cup, you know, because it's such an easy target. And you feel like there's a bunch of people who criticise the Shergar Cup who actually have never ever taken any interest in it. Yeah. When you go along, as you and I have done, it's good fun. It's a bit different. And, you know, it's so easy to say, oh, we shouldn't have stuff like this. Well, if you take away the Shergar Cup, then you need to come up with some sort of major feature racing event for that particular Saturday. And, you know, there's already not quite enough quality horses to go around. So I think it works well. It sort of does the job. Bit concerning to hear about 18,000 people. You know, you want more than that for a sort of family-based event. You know, it has to be a mass attendance thing, the Shergar Cup, or it's not going to work.
Of course, a link to that is the concert as well. It's always billed as the Shergar Cup and concert. I am not maybe the target audience. I suspect you're not as well, Liam. For the concert, they had Marvin Hume, and then a DJ and someone called Perry as the headline act.
Lee Scratch Perry? No.
Just said Perry.
Is that Perry, good? She was in Little Mix, I believe.
Okay.
I think.
Excellent. How big, 1 to 10, how big a draw is Perry?
For the younger sort of audience, fairly decent. But like you said, I think the whole concept of it's supposed to be a fun day. You know, there doesn't seem to be as much pressure as, you know, these big races you get at Ascot all the time and stuff, but 18,000 is a bit alarming from where the figures were a few years ago. So I guess in that aspect they've got to try and think of ways around that to bring that back up again. Obviously we've seen in recent weeks and so on that attendances at some of these big festivals have been going the other way and have been improving. So they've got to kind of draw the crowds in. But it is supposed to be fun, isn't it? The whole colour of the different teams in there, different representatives around the world. It's supposed to be a lot of fun. I was there on Thursday for the media morning, and they were putting up some of the fairground rides in the grandstand as well. I'd say it'd be a lot more of a day out for the non-race goers, kind of, yeah, the first timers.
It's not a purist day, is it?
No, for the die-hard racing fans, that they're probably saving themselves for York. Goodwood's just finished as well, so it's supposed to be a day for the family, for the fun. So it's alarming that the crowd figures are going down.
And although Chris is built around, if you like, a fun day, it's a day that also has six horse races, five, yeah, which worth 80 grand, one worth 100 grand, which is one of the points that Maureen Haggis made. So Maureen's line was that the standard of rider taking part on Saturday was, I quote, noticeably lower than usual, as a one or two, she said, should not have been there. Now, we did have some high-profile jockeys. We had Hugh Bowman, Mr. Winks. Right. Won the Silver Saddle. He won a race. Caris Teeton was riding there. We had jockeys who aren't so well known. In fact, probably more than ever before, who I think most racing fans have said, who is that? But one of them, Suraj Naridu from India, he had a really good win on Fireblade in the stage.
He was tactically aware in that race, wasn't
very
he?
Tactically
in a way
aware.
That you'd have to say most of the others were not.
Absolutely. And he, the great vibe afterwards, he brought 15 members of his family over from India. He's won the Indian Derby, and yet he said winning that race at Ascot was the highlight of his career. Well, so you can see,
I
how
bet
that
he was just being nice well, to the, maybe, the British press,
but
right?
Maybe,
but well
maybe.
Done him.
Absolutely,
for, yeah.
Yeah. But some of the riding, as you've pointed out in your piece, did raise question marks.
Yeah, so I think it is appropriate to make allowances. You know, if you put yourself in the position of these visiting jockeys, you can see how difficult it is. You're far away from home, you know, surrounded by strangers. There might be a language barrier. You might be working in your second language or your third language. Unfamiliar horses, unfamiliar race course, new rules, you know, new racing culture. As soon as you sort of bring some of these visiting jockeys over for an event like this, you can see why stuff would go wrong. Mm. And we've been at Sugar Cups in the past where stuff like that has happened. Yeah. You remember a trip to Paris, you know, a hold-up horse, yeah, and he went steaming off in front and got stuffed. So, I mean, there's always been an element of that. The difference this year, I think, is that they changed the format with the unintended consequence, probably, that you've suddenly got, like a large majority of visiting jockeys.
The format being the ladies' team went.
Yeah.
Well, the girls' team, as the girls, like the ladies like to call it. The ladies' team went and the team Asia came in.
Yes. It seems like a direct replacement.
Yeah.
As I say, you used to have riders in the ladies' team who would be mostly British or Irish-based. If you go back even just 2 years to the Sugar Cup we had then, the girls' team was Hayley, Holly, Safi, Osborne. The British and Irish team would have been, again, familiar jockeys, Tom Marquand, Declan McDonough, Luke Morris, and even in the European team, Frankie Dettori, Olivier Pellier, Torrey Hammer Hansen. Yeah. So that's 9 jockeys out of a total of 12 who are completely familiar with Ascot, yeah, and riding in Britain. And, you know, you could be a trainer or an owner entering your horse for a Sugar Cup race that year in total confidence, that you're probably going to get someone for whom the novelty is just not a factor at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if bad luck, you get someone who is completely new to the place, well, still you might get someone who's got a bit of star quality and, you know, who performs really well. So this Sugar Cup on Saturday, because you've got Team Asia being introduced, the only two jockeys who are regulars in Britain or Ireland were Joanna Mason and Holly Doyle. A guy like Hugh Bowman, he'd be completely, yeah, fine anyway. I think,
and he's ridden in Britain before, plenty.
Yeah, yeah, he'd won Ascot umpteen years ago. Caris Teeton, I was sure, was going to be fine, and he was fine. Yeah. You've still got a lot of newbies who are sort of figuring it out as they go along, and you've only got 5 rides in the day. And there was weird stuff happening, like, somebody took the blindfold off too late in the first race. I think he didn't realise that the stalls handler wasn't going to take it off for him. That would be what normally happens in his culture.
Which was surprising, because people like George Baker and Michael Hills were talking to the jockeys beforehand.
Briefing them, right?
Yeah, yeah. As did the stewards. And one of the things that George Baker said to me was that two of the things they'd been clearest in talking to the jockeys about was whip limitations.
Right, of course.
And procedures at the start, because in some jurisdictions, someone will take the hood off the horse for the jockey. and they couldn't do that here. They don't do that here.
For whatever reason, that message didn't get across for at least one guy. And then there was someone else who whipped it off too soon, and the horse crashed against the stalls before they opened, and he missed the kick as well. So I think basically in that first race, which was 10 runners, three of them missed the kick. And there was someone else had a problem with a blind later on. And every race on the round course seemed to be run at a funereal pace. And you know, there were other issues as well. There was a bit of interference going on, and it's difficult, you know, when you, as I say, for all those reasons I mentioned earlier, you can see why stuff goes wrong. And when you've got 10 newish jockeys out of 12, you're going to see more of that than I think you would in a normal Shergar Cup. So for the sake of the confidence of trainers and owners in the future, I think they might have to tweak that a bit.
So to Lynn, Chris is thinking that they need to look at the makeup of the jockeys next year. But maybe one factor, though, in terms of who they get, in terms of domestic jockeys, they're clearly limited in the sense that there are races taking place at Haydock and Newmarket the same day that have black type races. Mm-hmm. So anyone who's got a retainer might well be required there. The Phoenix Stakes card at the Curra used to take place on the Sunday, is now on the Saturday, which makes it harder to get high profile Irish jockeys.
Yeah.
And in terms of bringing in international talent, this is not the only international jockeys event that takes place in the calendar. There are quite a few. Are all around the world these days. Saudi, Hong Kong, Japan, they're not a new thing. There's a potential for, it's likely to be a global jockeys league starting next year if organisers get that one off the ground. A lot of these events, maybe all these events, they pay the jockeys to take part. Whereas at the Shergar Cup, clearly you can win prize money, good prize money too, and Hugh Bowman won a £3,000 prize for Silver Saddle. But the jockeys are rewarded with business class flights and four nights at a five-star hotel at Peniel Park, not too far from Ascot. Now, clearly, you know, for most people, that'd be a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
but if you're a mega box-earning jockey, maybe it's not quite as attractive. So getting some of the top names who you'd really want to sell a day like that, maybe it's not as easy as it used to be.
No, definitely not. I think, like you touched on there, that the fact that there's, you know, a lot of big races, you know, across Europe happening the same weekend, obviously we've seen in Ireland, in England, you know, there was group action at Haydock as well, and there was, you know, group one action in Germany as well. So a lot of these big named jockeys will have, you know, responsibilities elsewhere.
Yeah.
So, and you're kind of almost stuck because, for example, you have we had a team Great Britain and Ireland, you have a team Europe. You've got to place these jockeys in the right team to make it work. So the Shergar Cup is good in the sense that it allows the opportunity for these, you know, these jockeys that we might not see on a regular basis come and make a name for themselves. But the problem is that once the Shergar Cup's over, we might not see them again riding in Britain.
Probably not.
You know, it's not like we have a regular in the Shergar Cup. They usually try and mix it up and bring in a variety of different people. So it's an opportunity for them to kind of sell themselves, but at the same time, when you have big named people coming out like Maureen Haggis and saying what a lot of people probably will be thinking, then it will sort of stop trainers trying to, you know, to reach out to these jockeys and ask them to ride their horses.
I mean, to some extent, I sort of feel you don't really want the biggest international names to. You wouldn't want to try and tempt them to the Shergar Cup because so Joe Moreira would be a different case. I've seen him a couple of times at Shergar Cup, and he fully commits and gives it a great go. But I mean, you know, guys like Ryan Moore and Frankie Dettori, who, you know, they've done a few Shergar Cups, but latterly when I've seen them involved in that, you know, you can see that they're kind of wondering why they're there. You know, these are a string of handicaps. And you know, their main employers couldn't care less about the Shergar Cup. I think you want people who are going to throw themselves into the spirit of the event. Someone like Emma Jane Wilson, you know, who's really going to interact with the crowd and give it a real good go on her horse. So anybody who sort of thinks this is a bit beneath me or kind of gives off that vibe is best left where they were.
There,
you know,
was a suggestion that the two Japanese riders on Saturday, that perhaps they didn't engage with the event in the way that
they wanted to
leave the event early on Thursday. They didn't turn up for the ITV opener on Saturday. Right. I know that created some disappointment internally. So you're right. You've got to get people, I suppose, who have a high enough standard. A, that trainers will have confidence in them, and the public will want to go and see them. But also people who really will want to participate in the event. Because it's a fun event, and if you don't really want to be part of the fun, there ain't no point being there.
And we've got to not pretend in the media that what you're seeing here is a showcase of the very best jockeys from around the world. It's not going to be like that. Because those guys, for the most part, aren't going to be tempted by four nights in a very smart hotel and the chance of a winner at Ascot. You know, they're probably there at the Royal Meeting anyway. It's a fun thing, but you're going to see some instances of riding maybe a little bit below the standard you would normally expect. That's there every year. That's just one of the risks of the Shergar Cup. It's a bit like when you're watching racing at Goodwood. There's a big chance of getting trouble in running, and at the Shergar Cup, stuff happens that you wouldn't normally see. That's just the way it goes. But you do need to sort of keep that in check, by also having a reasonably high percentage of local jockeys who know what they're doing. There's a balance to be struck.
Do you know who is a good jockey, Liam? Definitely a good jockey. Billy Loughnan. So's Ashin Murphy. They both won Group 1s yesterday. Billy Loughnan on Rebels Romance, his first Group 1 on Rebels Romance. For him, it definitely wasn't the first Group 1 in Germany. Sagir was a surprisingly impressive winner of the Prix Maurice de Geest. For Ashin Murphy and Andre Farb. And on Saturday, Group 1 Glory for Ammo. First time in a while they've had that. Power Blue in the Phoenix Stakes. So away from the Shergar Cup, loads of Group 1s taking place.
Absolutely, and plenty for everyone to get the teeth stuck into. Ammo, I think they really needed that that top level win. I think it was the first time since King of Steel won on Champions Day in 2023 that they've got hold of that Group 1. So very important for them and the direction that they're going in. It's been well documented that the money that they've spent and things haven't gone probably like they will have wanted. But at the same time, they've been hitting the crossbar for a few times, and it was great to see them get that big race win. And it could be a huge sort of few weeks for the operation, and with York around the corner, they've got the favourite, Antipost favourite in the Nunthorpe.
Yeah, Arizona Blue.
Yeah, and I think it's they've got a few other chances. Obviously, we've seen Flowerhead at the Royal Meeting, really, really well performed, and at Goodwood as well. So you'd think, hopefully for them now, that once they've got that one, they can sort of continue sort of going in the right direction.
Chris, is it one of those Group 1 performances on the weekend that particularly struck you?
Well, I enjoyed Rebel's Romance. But
how could you not?
Yeah, exactly that. He's such a grand old stager. It's a pity he can't get into the Ark. I'd love to see him have a go at that race.
Ditto.
I thought it was kind of sad what happened to him in the King George, a small field, and he got trapped behind the two Coolmore front runners with the filly on his outside, and he never got a run. He having run so well last year, and I quite fancied him to win that race. I'm talking through my pocket as usual, right? But it was gutting to see horse of his standing get no chance at all at that. And there was some justice in him getting a Group 1 win in Germany and at the weekend. And good for Billy Loughnan, tough on William Buick, who would have been on him, but went to Deauville for a non-runner. There you go.
There you go indeed. That was part one of the front page. When we will return, it will be fixtureless chat, and I promise you it will be interesting. Welcome back to the front page with me, Lee Mottershead, Chris Cook and Liam Head. We're going to look now at last week's unveiling of the British fixtureless for 2026. In a nutshell, almost the same number of fixtures taking place next year, programmed anyway, as there were this year. 1,458 fixtures are due to take place in 2026. Two more, also two down on 2025. We'd already reported that the number of Premier race days is being slashed to 52 from 162. Protected window goes. In terms of real new news, it's about money that's being pumped into the sport in a bid to ensure that we have more horses taking part in the sport, and particularly more high quality horses taking part in Britain's best races, because we're well aware that there has been this equine talent drain in recent years. There has been, or there will be, a significant uplift in the four major Midsummer Group 1 races, the King George, the July Cup, the International and the Sussex Stakes. There'll be a rise, a significant rise to minimum values for Class 1, so Group 1 listed races in Britain, and a significant as well pumping in of money to developmental races on the flat and over jump, so novice races and maiden races, again as a bid to make the sport more attractive to owners of quality horses. And Liam, one point I made in the column today is that there's often a perception that British racing's prize money relative to France and Ireland is mediocre, when the stats just don't bear that out, particularly the top level. Our major races over jumps and on the flat compare very favourably indeed to those jurisdictions. Where we have suffered is in developmental races, so maiden races, novice races. This will correct that, and part of a wider effort to reward the better horses, the reason, the thinking being that it's the top of any sport that is sold to potential fans. Are you in broad agreement or broad opposition?
No, in agreement. I think, you know, these maiden races, novice races, it's where we first get a glimpse of these promising horses on the track for the first time. So it's important that their sort of, you know, progression to the top is rewarded. We all know that prize money has been a real problem in the sport for a number of years, and it's, while it is great to see the bigger races getting bigger in terms of prize money, I think valuing the lesser races is a lot more important for the future of the sport.
When you say lesser races, which races?
You know, like the developmental races.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah,
you
yeah.
know, obviously yeah. the prize money in a lot of these Group 1 races are very good anyway, but in comparison to ones around the world that, yeah. you know, that they're not, but no. the fact that we're the fact that the sport is going to be investing a lot more. You mentioned the King George.
Yeah.
I spoke to Nick Smith there, but a few weeks ago, you know, on the day of the King George, and he was saying it was a statement of intent from the sport, and you know, they're hoping to attract, you know, more runners from all over the world for, you know, to put racing on the global scene. So. But going back to what I was saying, you know, these races, the developmental races, you know, the maidens and novices, this is the first opportunity we get to see, you know, the some of these horses. So, you know, seeing them for the first time and rewarding, you know, connections for going for these races is crucial for you know, what happens later on in their careers.
Chris, did you like what you read in the fixtures announcement?
It reminded me of when we have these blooming fixture list announcements every year. The major stumbling block is that the BHA is not actually free to make the decisions it wants to make, because, yeah. You know, the intervention of the Office of Fair Trading now 22 years yeah. ago, it means that we don't have central control of fixtures anymore. The racecourses have ownership of about 85% of
yeah,
the fixtures. So, you know, if it's decided centrally, or indeed across the sport, that we've got too much racing and we need to contract the fixture list a bit and hopefully bump up field sizes, they just can't do anything about it, because, you know, there's going to be no agreement on who's going to bear the pain. So I even sometimes find myself wondering if there's any way to revisit that intervention by the OFT, if it would be possible to go back to them and say, well, look, we have tried, we made an honest effort for 20 years to try and make this work, but here we are in a really difficult situation where our sport needs to make some difficult decisions, and you've hamstrung us. We can't do it.
Well, because that was at the heart of racecourse concerns in relation to Charles Allen as incoming yeah. chair. So a lot of the negotiations were about, well, a lot of the fear within racecourses was that if Allen wants the BHA to be a more commercial beast, as the BHA has nothing to be commercial with, really, apart from its operation in the fixtures, in which it is quite impotent, would the BHA under his control want to revisit the racecourse ownership of racecourse fixtures? And I think it's only because racecourses seem to have been reassured that that won't happen that we've maybe reached this point where Charles Allen will be the incoming chair of the BHA.
It's all very well, but he may have painted himself into a corner. You know, if he's already given up on that particular debate, then you know, there's so much less room for manoeuvre in the future. Anyway, so two fewer fixtures than last year, which is next to nothing, and I think the final total is only something like 3% lower than the record number of fixtures ever, which, when you consider how long we've been talking about too much racing, you know, it's absolutely bizarre that we haven't been able to make any progress in that direction.
It is. But again, I suppose part of the problem too is that the way the sports funding model works, it's funded based around race fixture generation, isn't it? No fixture loses money, and they all put money into
the sport. So we're told.
So we're told, and that being the case, I suppose the BHA is quite reluctant.
But then there's this other dynamic, isn't there, that when you have so many fixtures, the field size goes down, and that in itself reduces your income from in all sorts of different ways. You know, look, if you had a guy like Charles Allen at the centre who was empowered to make that decision, I'm pretty sure he could build quite a broad consensus in favour of cutting back on the number of fixtures, but he just can't do it. And therefore, it sort of feels like the whole of the rest of the debate around fixtures is just kind of working around this central disability.
But at some point, guys, there will have to be a change, surely, not least because there are going to be fewer horses. You know, it's been well documented by the TBA and elsewhere that the foal crop in Britain and Ireland is going down, and it's potentially going to go down at a pretty alarming rate in the relatively near future. So how can you service a fixture list that is already troubled by inadequate field sizes if those fields are set to get much smaller in the future if we maintain the same number of fixtures, because we're going to lose 10, 20, 30% of the available horse population to run in those races?
I think it's just, I mean, it's kind of like we're trying to take it as far as we can before something major happens, like but you know, you're waiting for the wheels almost to think, right, we need to do something right now. I mean, you know, two fixtures lost from 2025 to 2026, what is that in the grand scheme of things? It's absolutely nothing. I mean, you'd hardly realise it. I mean, you go back to what you were saying there, Chris, about we're not far off the record of, you know, of fixtures we've had it in a year. And you know, you could ask sort of trainers, stable staff even, you know, who are having to make these, you know, trips to halfway across the country on a Sunday, for example, for it's like when we tried the Sunday evening race and it went down like a lead balloon, didn't it? Like, it was just bonkers. And I think, you know, that we have breaks in the season. I know we've just come back from a 2-week jumps break as well, but there just seems to be too much of it at the minute. I mean, all well and good is the fact that we are seeing more money getting pumped into the sport, into these races. You know, the Group 1 and Grade 1 races are getting stronger in terms of prize money, but if you can't fill them, then you know, you don't want to see, you don't want to see three, four runner races, do you? In anything. No.
But and I hear what you're saying about the declining horse population sort of forcing us into a situation where a decision seems necessary.
Hopefully.
But if nobody's empowered to make that decision, you know, I can just imagine the sport trying to struggle along without changing anything seriously.
Well, maybe a fully independent BHA board under a strong BHA chair might be able to do
that. They're going to definitely come up with suggestions, right? But if they can't force it through, then, you know, why should any individual racecourse or racecourse group agree to take the pain if they don't see that it's also being borne by everyone else?
Something else that Charles Allen will no doubt be looking at when he starts in the role in September is the threat the government's plans to harmonise gambling tax rates. Chris Gordon-Brown, former Prime Minister, former Chancellor of the Exchequer, entered the debate last week. Did you just pricey what he was saying?
Well, he had a big article in The Guardian, it's still online, you can go and read it, mainly focused on his great concern about child poverty, which he says, you know, has grown terribly in this country over the last 15 years. And, you know, he being a very principled and engaged politician, clearly that bothers him. He wants to do something about it. That part of the article, you know, no one clearly could have any argument with. But then he moves on to saying, you know, since we have to come up with, you know, some funds to tackle this issue, let's
tax the gambling industry.
Yeah.
He says it's undertaxed. He compares it with tax rates in other jurisdictions, including some in America, where he says tax rates are much higher. We still saw a response from the Betting and Gaming Council at the end of the week saying, you know, all the reasons why they disagree with what he said, and fundamentally, if tax rates go up, punters will suffer. I would guess there's a lot of people out there who are sort of wondering, well, why does it have to be the betting industry that pays for what you need to do to help kids get out of poverty? So the response from a politician would be, that's where we think the money is. And I was pleased to see him sort of acknowledge the need for some kind of carve-out for horse racing, but I think he was talking in that article about a sum of money to compensate the sport for the loss of income from gambling. That's just not going to adequately fill the hole that will be created.
But it seems as though Gordon Brown is proposing the same thing as a social market foundation think tank, whereby, and this is really interesting,
he linked
work
to them.
On for one, whereby those people who we might have classed before as, maybe still do, as anti-gambling campaigners, are trying to forge relationships with racing. We've already seen positive words from the NTF about this plan, whereby they're saying don't harmonise tax rates, don't make racing the same as gaming, as slots, a casino. Actually, what you should do is you should whack up the rate for gaming, and you should bring down the rate for horse racing. And the Social Market Foundation and Gordon Brown proposing that you actually increase, if you like, the levy rate from 10% to 20%, and you reduce the tax rate, if you like, for racing from 15% to 5%. And of course, you've then got that question of, okay, well, that sounds great, but would it actually work, in the sense that would you just end up for racing with a bigger slice of a smaller cake, because bookmakers react anyway, because they say, well, if our profits have been hit across the board, we're just not going to ignore racing. We're going to have to take issues with racing.
I mean, it does feel like, you know, gambling is under sustained assault and has been for a number of years. It seems nearly inevitable to me that is going to have negative consequences for horse racing, given that so much of the sport's income comes from betting. Mm. I'm pleased to see, you know, people acknowledging, the need to do something to support the sport if that money is in decline. But, I can't see that it's going to be enough to plug whatever hole is created.
No. Liam, what's your week got in store?
Week, I'm at Newbury.
So am I, actually.
Yes, Newbury Friday and Saturday.
Yes, hundreds of stakes. Jeffrey Freer stakes.
Yes. Yeah, so looking forward to that and some more warm weather.
Yeah, it's going to get hot.
Yeah.
I'm a bit worried, I've got to say, for the early season novice chases. You know, at some stage there's got to be some rain, right? But none on the horizon. Am I the only one who wants summer to end
quickly?
It's
a measure of the man that Chris Cook is, that as we approach another heat wave, his primary concern is for those early season novice chases.
Well, and, you know, also the people of Scottish extraction who are going to suffer in this terrible heat in England that they're just not born for.
Yes. Well, let's pray for Mr. Cook. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Lee.
Pleasure.
Thank you for watching. We shall return next week when there will no doubt be much discussion about the Ebor Festival that will follow starting a week on Wednesday. Until then, have a great week. See you soon. Bye-bye.